We'd like to start today's program by talking about the latest developments in the fight against HIV and AIDS. The 20th Annual International AIDS Conference is currently taking place in Melbourne, Australia. It's happening at a time when new options are being introduced to treat and prevent the virus, and one of the most talked about treatments is known as PrEP. That stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis. It's sold under the brand name Truvada. It involves taking a pill once a day to prevent HIV infections in populations that are at high risk, such as men who have sex with men. But even with all the excitement at treatment breakthroughs, the conference started on a sad note. A number of longtime HIV/AIDS researchers were killed in the crash of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 in Ukraine last week. We wanted to hear more about the conference and the latest developments in AIDS research, so we've called Dr. Anthony Fauci. He's the director of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health. He's just back from the conference, and he's with us now. Dr. Fauci, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
And I do want to express my condolences on the loss of these colleagues. You were close to a number of the people, so I'm so sorry, you know,
for that.
I did want to ask what the mood was like at the conference. Did it cast a pall over things?
Well, it did in the beginning because as everyone was getting off their own planes from all parts of the world, this is the international meeting that occurs every 2 years, the news spread throughout the conference immediately, and there was a deep feeling of sadness and loss. So expectedly, you would see that rather than the somewhat festive atmosphere that you usually see when people gather together at the beginning of a meeting, it really was rather sad with a deep feeling of loss. As the meeting went on, it really transformed into from a feeling of sadness and loss to one of inspiration to get the job done because our colleagues who were lost really were the kinds of people that were very much enthusiastic about getting to the end game of controlling this epidemic. So it became more of an inspiration as the days of the meeting went on.
And one of the reasons it was so tragic is that you do feel, as I understand it, within the community of HIV/AIDS researchers, that you are kind of closing in on it. Is that right?
Well, there's no doubt that, you know, this is an epidemic that was first recognized just about 33 years ago. So 33 years of work on this when the dark days of the early years were going in the wrong direction. Now we're starting to make considerable progress in the arenas both of treatment and saving people's lives, but also in prevention, in preventing infections that were at a terribly high rate in the mid-80s, the early 90s, that are now throughout the world in many cases starting to turn around with a deflection in the curve due to the advances in treatment and prevention.
We talked about PrEP 3 years ago in this program, and the World Health Organization recently recommended that those of high risk of contracting HIV should take the pill. Why is the public health community particularly excited about this development?
Well, they're excited about it because the clinical trials have now incontrovertibly shown that if used properly and people take the pill, and this is a pill that has two drugs in it that are highly effective against HIV, it's taken by people who are not infected as a prophylaxis or prevention to get infected and to prevent infection. And when you look at the data, if people actually take the pill, and one of the problems is people don't like to take pills, but those who do, the efficacy is greater than 90%. That is very, very impressive. So the World Health Organization and our own Centers for Disease Control and Prevention here in the United States are recommending that people and a few subcategories who are at particularly high risk should seriously consider taking this pre-exposure prophylaxis.
You know, I understand that in the scientific community, there's a strong consensus behind it, but I understand that culturally among some groups, it's actually kind of a controversial thing for a number of reasons. I mean, you know, there are some people who think that it encourages more risky behavior. It could. And then there are other people who just look at the cost. At present, it costs about $35 per pill. That's about $13,000 a year. People say, well, you know, condoms are cheap. So what do you think about that?
I think if you balance the advantages versus the disadvantages, in my mind, in the mind of virtually all of my colleagues in the scientific and public health arena, feel that it weighs heavily towards being beneficial. There are those who say, understandably, that you're supposed to be using condoms. Everyone who is at risk should be using condoms. they feel that if this pill becomes available, people will stop using condoms. And yet follow-up studies in the cohort from the original study show that by taking this pill or by having the pill available, this has not led to a behavior change in putting people at greater risk. It's just not the case. You could understand how people might feel that way, but it is not the case. It doesn't encourage risky behavior. And besides, it's not supposed to be used as a substitution for other types of prevention. It should be used to complement. But there are people who just won't use a condom. As much as you try to convince them how important it is, they don't. And this is a methodology of prevention that clearly works if used properly. And that's the reason why we're enthusiastic about, on the circumstances where people can benefit, that they use it.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Anthony Fauci. He's one of the country's leading HIV/AIDS researchers. He's director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, and he just got back from the annual International AIDS Conference, which is taking place in Melbourne, Australia right now. You know, the new infection rates in this country have been relatively stable since the mid-1990s. I mean, obviously, we understand that this is a worldwide health issue, but just looking at the United States, the rates have grown among African-American men who have sex with men. And they're, you know, African-Americans as a group are the ethnic group in this country still most affected, and that the rates among young African-American men are particularly worrisome. Why is that, do you think?
It's a complicated array of sociological issues. The population of African-Americans in the United States is about 12-13%. And if you look at the number of new infections in general in the United States each year, about 50% of them are among African Americans. And when you talk about African American women, about 55-60% of all new infections among women are among African American women. So what you said is entirely correct. The reason for that is really because of the predominance in African American men who have sex with men and the disenfranchisement of that population, the stigma associated with that among African men who have sex with men compared to Caucasians men who have sex with men is really striking. A relative lack of community support, a stigma that is clearly out of proportion when you compare it to the Caucasian population. So we've got to, you know, access and embrace these people to get them involved in testing and counseling to avoid infection if they are not infected, and if they are infected, to get them into therapy, because we know from this phenomenon called treatment as prevention that when you treat people who are infected and get their viral load to below a detectable level, you dramatically diminish the likelihood that they will infect their sexual partners. So by accessing a relatively disenfranchised population and getting them into the care continuing and getting them into counseling and getting them into treatment can go a long way to reversing this really profound health disparity, which is really disfavors or puts at greater risk the African American population.
Is it that the networks to reach this particular group don't exist because they tend to be medically disenfranchised, right? Or as well as culturally disenfranchised? Or is it that the networks exist but people don't use them?
It's a combination of both. If you compare the networks among African American men who have sex with men compared to white men who have sex with men, the networks are much, much less in existence. And those that are in existence are not nearly as effective as they can be. So not only it's the stigma, it's when looks, for example, in certain inner city areas, economically deprived people, people who have a variety of other sociological issues that impact on them, drug use, crime, economic problems, all of those things contribute together with the stigma to make this a much more difficult population to be able to get into a program that would help them in counseling and getting them into care.
So at this juncture in our history and in the history of the fight against this epidemic, what are you most challenged by and what are you most hopeful about?
Well, I think what we're challenged by relates very much to what we're talking about right now. It's accessing populations, special populations, one of the most important discussions that took place in the Melbourne meeting was that rather than look at the AIDS pandemic as a homogeneous phenomenon, it's just not. It's really quite selective. There are hot spots of infection. There are global hot spots, and within countries, there are regional hot spots, and even within cities, there are hot spots. And what we need to do is to focus on people to try and access them, to get them into a healthcare continuum. And so we have the tools, we just need to apply them. And what makes me hopeful is that I think if we put our energy and our commitment, our political and moral commitment into this, it will happen.
That was Dr. Anthony Fauci. He's director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He's one of this country's top AIDS researchers. He's just back from the International AIDS Conference in Melbourne, Australia, and was nice enough to join us from the National Institutes of Health, which is in Bethesda, Maryland. Dr. Fauci, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're quite welcome. Nice being with you.
Now we'd like to talk about something that we all see but rarely talk about. We are talking about casting in the movies. And there's a casting call that's gotten an unusual amount of attention. It was posted on Facebook last week by Sandae Alisi Casting. They were searching for featured extras for the upcoming biopic about the pioneering rap group NWA. The casting call asked for women aged 18 to 30 in ranks A through D. The A women could be of any race but had to be, quote, the hottest of the hottest, models, must have real hair, very classy looking, great bodies, unquote. The B women were asked to be Beyonce types with long natural hair, really nice bodies, and light skin. Quoting again, the C women were African American girls, medium to light skinned with a weave, and the D women were, quote, African American girls, poor, not in good shape, with medium to dark skin tone, unquote. Universal Studios is behind the movie, and they released an apology statement saying, quote, the filmmakers did not approve and do not condone the information in this casting notice, unquote. No word yet on whether they will continue to work with the casting company. And if you were interested, we did reach out to Sandae Alisi Casting, but they did not respond. Nevertheless, we felt this was important to talk about because some people feel, and a lot of writers have expressed, that this casting call just put in stark terms something that is, in fact, the norm in Hollywood anyway, which is attitudes about size, skin color, and beauty, and how those factors play into who gets what roles. We have a distinguished panel of industry insiders to talk about this, and they are Linda Lowy. She's a casting director who's worked on shows like Private Practice, Grey's Anatomy, and Scandal. Rick Nahara is a film writer, actor, and producer. He's worked in films including Nothing Like the Holidays and shows such as In Living Color. He's a regular in our Barbershop Roundtable, and he's also author of the book Almost White, Forced Confessions of a Latino in Hollywood. Nana Mensa is an actress on the breakout web series An African City. She's also writer and director and star of the upcoming feature film Queen of Glory. And Bill Duke is a producer and director. You know him from his work on camera in films like X-Men: The Last Stand and his many directing credits, including Sister Act 2, and he produced the acclaimed documentary Dark Girls that explores issues around skin color hierarchy. And welcome to you all. We're also glad you could be with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
I'm just going to go around briefly and ask each of you just what was your reaction to this casting call. Linda Lowy, I'll start with you as somebody who's done casting for a number of notable shows.
I was somewhat shocked by it, but not really surprised. And then I noticed that it was a casting call for featured extras. That usually is something that is a non-speaking role. So I was a little surprised by it because it seemed so odd to me. It seemed unnecessarily complicated and scarily politically incorrect. So
okay, well, let's ask the other folks. Whether Bill Duke, what do you think?
I wasn't shocked by it, and yes, as she said, it was a featured extra, which means that they'll be seen a little more than others. And it's also the context within which the other people in the film will see it. They call it background. But in the perception of the creative folks, this is the reality of that background, and they were casting it as they saw it. The expression of it, I think, was a little insensitive, but I think it's the reality that we face.
Rick, what do you think?
Oh, I think it's totally the reality. I mean, it's NWA. They're talking about a hip-hop culture and movie, so of course it's going to be even more blatant, but it works in every single area of Hollywood. I mean, it's the background to them is they're wall paintings. They're not really even people. They want to slap up the wall, and the wall's going to be in these kind of colors and this kind of grading, how we're going to grade it. So it's dehumanizing, but it's one of the first times that people are as open about it. And this is how the industry really honestly thinks.
Nana Mensa, what about you? Have you ever seen a casting call like this? And being honest about it, have you ever answered one? Or have you even thought about answering one, even just for the sake of getting some kind of a shot?
Well, you know, that's the interesting thing is that, you know, the thing that really resonated with me when I was looking at this casting call for the first time was, you know, thinking about the girls like myself, you know, who aspiring to get their shot in Hollywood would be looking for themselves in A girls. Okay, I'm not an A girl. Okay, B girl, I'm not a B girl. Which, by the way, Beyonce is a prototype for a B girl. What universe are we living in where Beyonce is a B girl? It's like, that's, I don't want to live in that universe if Beyonce is touted as a B girl. But anyway, C girl, I'm not a C girl. Okay, so then I must be a D girl. And it's like that self-identification of being, you know, a D girl. It's like, what is that doing for the psyche of the young women, you know, the young girls who all they want to do is act and are thinking that background work is how they're going to get their shot.
It's true. To actually force someone to grade themselves is pretty...
Was that the part that was hard for you? Because because really what I hear each of you saying is that you know that this exists. This is in fact the way people think. But what is it that made this thing stand out? Was it asking people to put themselves in that category?
I think what Bill said was very astute in that it's just an insensitive way to present it. Look, you know, I can't even imagine extras and what that must be like, because you're talking about hundreds, sometimes thousands of people. You know, in my world, we try to get as specific as possible to avoid getting over 5,000 submissions for one part in a period of a day or two if we don't have to. So the more specific you can get, the better it is. However, you know, there is language that you can use, and I think this A, B, C, D, even if they meant it to be like 1, 2, 3, 4, it's like a grading system. But I will tell you, I'll be a B girl if Beyonce is a B girl.
I aspire to be a B girl.
Well, Bill, did your documentary, Dark Girls, that's really what it's about in a way, isn't it? It's about what it means to have light skin or dark skin and what the impact that this has, even in a way that people might not want to admit that it has. So just talk a little bit about that. I mean, so in a way, didn't this casting call just say what people think anyway? They just put it in writing?
Yes, and it's not only the way people think about our community, but it also reflects how we think about ourselves. In our culture, for example, the brown paper bag test, many years ago, you could not get into a club unless your skin was lighter than a brown paper bag, and if it was darker, you were left to the side like chattel. Online today, if you go online and look under hashtag team light girls and hashtag team dark skin girls, you'll see on each side a membership of both 200,000 approximately that are still dealing with this issue today. So it's a perception of beauty that has to a certain extent from slavery been imposed, but it's a perception of beauty that we accept and we live within our own community.
We have that in the Latino world, too.
Talk about that, Rick Najera.
It's the indigenous versus the European. And in terms of Latinos, they're Caribbean. It's African versus European. And which side of the grade scale? They used to have a saying in Puerto Rico was, you know, ¿Dónde está tu abuela? Where is your grandmother? And the thought was, if she's dark, she's in the kitchen. And they wouldn't bring her out. So that was a way of putting someone down. And, you know, and you see it throughout Latin America, and you see it in Africa, too.
I screened Dark Girls last year for this high school, and at the end of the screening, these two little dark-skinned girls were sitting in the second row, and they were weeping. And some of the ladies in the audience put their arms around them and asked them why were they crying. And they had said that, you know, the senior prom had passed, and they were the only two girls not invited to the senior prom. And that was a little heartbreaking.
I have a clip if we can play it. Do you want to play a short clip? I don't know if this is the specific clip that you were thinking of here, Bill Duke, but let me play a short clip from the documentary, if I may.
I can remember being in the bathtub asking my mom to put bleach in the water so that my skin would be lighter and so that I could escape the feelings that I had about not being as beautiful, as acceptable, as lovable.
If we're all just hanging around and a dark-skinned girl will pass by, they'll be like, oh, well, she's pretty for a dark-skinned girl. And I'm like, what is that supposed to mean?
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the controversy around a casting call for the upcoming biopic. It's about the rap group N.W.A. and the casting director, the casting agent, Sandé Alisi, made some very specific requests for people of different skin tones that seemed to, apply, some value judgments to people based on what those skin tones were. We're talking about this with a panel of industry insiders, including the producer, director, actor Bill Duke, Rick Nahara, also a producer, a director, and actor, Nana Mensa, the same, and casting director Linda Lowe. So do you think, well, Linda, let me ask you this. One of the things that shows like Grey's Anatomy and Scandal have been noted for, critically acclaimed for, the stories are unusual, but also the casting that doesn't fall into the usual tropes, right? And
right.
I just wondered, what was that? How did that come about? And why do you feel like you've been so successful with that, and yet you're still getting casting calls like this? What's your take on that?
At the beginning, 11 years ago, when I met Shonda Rhimes, she looked at the things that I had done, and she said, I just want you to cast the show, Grey's Anatomy, the way you see the world. I'm not going to give anybody a last name. And I said to her, before I even started, I just wanted to make sure that it's all ethnicities for every role, because otherwise I wasn't really interested. And she said that, all ethnicities for all roles. The only role she insisted, she had to have a Caucasian woman, preferably blonde, was the role of Dr. Bailey, which, as you all know, is Chandra Wilson. Like, I just go with my instinct, and if I see something really great, I bring it to the producers and director, no matter what it is, no matter what's been said at the beginning, because as you go along, things change.
I think that that's phenomenal. I also recognize the fact that that is absolutely not the norm. It's like the one thing that the four of us have each said when we talked about this casting call was that, yes, it is despicable, but yes, we are not surprised.
Can I just ask you, though, with Rick Nahara, the fact is, well, you also made the point that this isn't something that just affects African Americans. Like, for example, I'm thinking it certainly affects Latinos and Latinas. Sofia Vergara, who's the Colombian actress best known for her role in Modern Family, said when she first came to Hollywood, she couldn't get roles because her hair is in fact blonde. So she had to,
they told her
she didn't look Latina enough. Mm-hmm. So that she had to dye her hair darker.
I met Salma Hayek when she came into town. She didn't look Mexican.
That's what they said. But with the country becoming much more diverse, why does this persist? Is it because people are afraid to do something differently, or because they feel that this part of the audience doesn't matter, or what's the deal there?
When you look at people, especially in the Latino world, it affects us in so many ways, like immigration. The big thing happening in Marietta and places like that. When they're talking about Latinos and this horde of Latinos, and they're calling Ann Coulter saying the Browning of America. It's the images you're seeing on television of Latinos are really bad. Mm. So when you think of Latino, you're thinking of those images, the drug lords and all that. And they tend to make them darker, And the truth is, I have two friends who are undocumented that came over. They have more degrees than I do, much more intelligent than I am. And I was born here, full citizen. My father fought in Vietnam, World War II. My uncle died in World War II. Total American, Mexican-American. But I'm not on TV. And that's the problem. When you're not seeing us on TV, it affects immigration laws. It affects all how America sees Latinos, and that's about color.
Bill Duke, Lupita Nyong'o made such a splash, won an Oscar for her role in 12 Years a Slave. And you said she's going to be on the cover of the book version of Darko, your documentary. Does a breakout role like that, a breakout performer like that, change it, or does it just change it for that person?
I think that's a great question. My prayer is that it changes it. But we have yet to see whether or not that's the reality. Wouldn't it be wonderful to see a movie with a dark-complected woman as the female lead? When I say that, I mean in a major motion picture on a consistent level, that it's not an anomaly, but somehow her humanity rather than her color is the thing that we really kind of look at. Because, again, media is very powerful, and there's two sins involved. The sin of commission, when you put black people or Hispanics up there and they're clowns or they're criminals or they're something negative, that's one sin. But the sin of omission is when there's ever anything wonderful or royal or stoic, we're not there.
I did mention at the beginning that we reached out to Sandé Alisi. We were not able to get them to participate in this conversation. They did speak to TMZ, and they said the casting call was, quote, an innocent mistake, and when it comes to casting poor people, they're also looking for women of various skin tones and body types, unquote. Everybody laughed.
Was that serious or was that a joke?
Let me just ask each of you for a final thought. Linda, go on as you go first.
First of all, Shonda Rhimes being an African-American female showrunner, there's not a lot of that in Hollywood. Let's face facts. Putting Kerry Washington, I mean, that role was based on a real woman, the role in Scandal, a woman named Judy Smith, who was African-American. There was all the articles in the paper that, you know, it's the first time in 30 or 40 years that there's been a female African-American lead of a television show. Now, you know, we have Halle Berry, we've got Octavia Spencer, we've got Taraji Henson, and Viola Davis, who I cast in another show that's picked up for the fall season called How to Get Away with Murder, all actresses that are leads of television shows. That's what happened with Scandal.
Success breeds success. Rick, final thought?
Yeah, I think it really starts with the writers. I'm a proud member of the WGA, but unfortunately sometimes it's the whitest guild of America. And you look at the numbers, it's not me, it's actually there, and you'll see it. And until that changes, you won't see some real change.
Bill Duke?
I hope there's an investment in our children's futures so that this curse of this madness and silliness of colorism and racism will address it so that our children will not inherit this madness.
Nana, final thought?
I just hope that, you know, what we've seen with all these leading women that Linda was just listing who are, you know, heading TV shows, I just hope that if the shows do not produce the ratings that Scandal has and they are canceled, that we don't wait another 30 years to try again. Because that seems to be the thing that continues to happen, is that the shows happen and then, you know, they aren't successful and then we stop trying. So I think a persistence to actually reflect America as it currently stands is, you know, that commitment is paramount.
Nana Mensa is an actress on the Breakout web series, An African City. She joined us from our bureau in New York City. Rick Nahar is a film writer, actor, and producer. He's worked on a number of films, including Nothing Like the Holidays and programs like In Living Color. His latest book is called Almost White, Forced Confessions of a Latino in Hollywood. Bill Duke is a producer and director. He produced the acclaimed documentary Dark Girls. Rick and Bill were both with us from NPR West, which is in Culver City, California. Linda Lowy is a casting director who's worked on many, many shows, including Grey's Anatomy and Scandal. She was with us from her office in Los Angeles. Thank you all so much for speaking with us. We appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
Thank you.
We are continuing the conversation about race and color in show business as we hear from a Hollywood pioneer, the legendary Rita Moreno. When she started her career in the 1940s, it seemed as though her Puerto Rican heritage would limit her career options. Nevertheless, she went on to become the only Hispanic and one of only a handful of people who've won all four of the entertainment industry's most prestigious awards, the Tony, the Oscar, the Grammy, and the Emmy. When we first went on the air in 2007, she was one of the first entertainment luminaries I interviewed for our Wisdom Watch segment. That's where we talk to people who've made an impact through their lives and work, as she certainly has. We talked about those early days as a young Latina in Hollywood and her Oscar-winning role as Anita in the iconic 1961 film West Side Story. But we started by talking about her experience coming to the mainland from Puerto Rico with her mother as a young girl.
My first American experience was in the harbor of New York City when I saw that amazing big tall lady. I remember thinking, oh my goodness, a lady runs this country.
Really? Oh, that's great.
A little prescient, but I think it's about to happen.
It could be. When did the performing bug bite you?
When I was in Puerto Rico, but when I was a tiny little girl, literally 3 and 4, I was dancing for Grandpa. They would put on these wonderful rumba records, or salsa records, and I would shake my booty all over the living room. Boy, you talk about meant to be. Oh, my goodness. I have never done anything else in my life except be a performer.
As I remember, you made your Broadway debut at 13?
I made my debut at 13, passing for 11 and looking 9.
But, you know, that sounds so magical and wonderful, but that's a tough schedule for a 13-year-old.
Well, it sounds magical, and sometimes it felt magical, but the truth is that I had a very difficult time as a Puerto Rican in New York. My experience was really no different from any other immigrant that came to this country. It was rough. The kids were not nice to me in school. It was not a friendly place for Puerto Ricans.
What do you mean? How so?
Well, there was a lot of racial prejudice that was very, you know, out in the open. And it followed me for many, many years in movies. Producers looking right through me, never saying hello when I was doing a part in some film. And, you know, there's a way of being racially insulting to someone without ever using the bad words. You get bypassed. It is assumed that you can only speak with an accent. In those days particularly, if you had a Hispanic name, and I started off as Rosita Moreno, you never were offered parts other than the little Spanish Spitfire or you know, that kind of thing. So
you said, you know, you changed your name from Rosita to Rita. Did the studios ask you to do that?
Oh, yeah. Actually, my true name is Rosa Dolores Alverio. And then I became Rosita Moreno when a stepfather stepped in. And when I got to MGM Studios, which was my first film contract, they just thought that Rosita wasn't a good name, and they changed it to Rita. And yes, it was their idea.
And tell me about those early days as a contract player. I know that you got the Latin Spitfire roles. And did you chafe even then? I mean, it's so hard for actors to get work, period. I just wonder, were you so busy working that you just kind of put your head down and got through it? Or was it even then you were thinking, give me a break?
I aspired to so much more than that. And it was really a rather heartbreaking time for me, because when I was out of work, I was miserable. And when I got work, I was relieved temporarily, and then I would be doing the same kind of roles where I had to talk like this. You know, like Lolita? Well, I'm going to show you. And then I would get depressed all over again, because it's not what I wanted to do. It was not the happiest young girlhood. It really wasn't.
Was there anyone you could talk to about all of this? Was there any confidant that you had who understood what it was like to be, you know, a Latina performer out there?
No, because there weren't any other people like me. I was really it. If I was doing a movie that had supposed to have Hispanic people in it, they were maybe extras. But I also played a lot of Indian maidens, American Indians. You know, it was just ridiculous when you think about it. But there I was in buckskins and in these B-Westerns with feathers sticking out of my head. It made me into a very neurotic little Puerto Rican girl, I'll tell you that.
And when you say neurotic, is it a feeling just not fitting in anywhere?
Not fitting in anywhere and feeling very inferior. And I grew up feeling that way. My mom, unfortunately, wasn't a big help in that particular sense, because she felt the same way about herself.
How did she feel about your work?
She was terribly proud of me. And one of the greatest moments of my life is the night that I won the Oscar for West Side Story, and she was sitting right in back of me in the theater. It was a very emotional evening.
What was that like for you to hear your name called? I mean, I'm only imagine sitting there.
I was so nervous. But I remember thinking, as my name was called and my mom hugged me, and I remember thinking, don't you dare run to the stage. You go up there with dignity. Because I remember in the past having seen actresses practically tripping over themselves to get up to the stage to grab that, you know, golden man. And I said, don't you dare. And I didn't.
The film was released in 1961, but how can we forget this?
Puerto Rico, my heart's devotion, let it sink back in the ocean. Always the hurricane's blowing, always the population growing, and the money owing, and the sunlight streaming, and the natives steaming. I like the island Manhattan.
I know you do.
Smoke on your pipe and put Latin.
Okay, that's enough of that.
Oh, you know, I love hearing that.
Do you? I was going to ask if you ever get sick of it.
Oh, no, my goodness. It's just such a fabulous number, don't you think?
Of course I do. And that's why I wanted to ask you, is this complicated for you? Because on the one hand, a huge break for you, a huge, huge visibility and a tremendous award. This is a film that still gives people so much pleasure. And yet you're still with the accent. You're still with the brown makeup. I don't know.
Boy, boy, oh boy, and did we hate that, because we kept trying to let them know that Puerto Ricans were all colors, from pitch black to beige. But I heard somewhere that it was Jerome Robbins who kept saying, I want more contrast, I want more contrast. And there was one makeup shade for all of us who were playing the sharks, which just, I hated that. I was so offended by that. I was very torn. It was a wonderful role. It was a great opportunity to work with a genius, Jerome Robbins, to sing and dance to this astonishing music. But yeah, there was always that niggling, terrible feeling that you weren't really representing your people.
Has anyone ever said that to you? You know, sometimes the next generation isn't as tolerant of the choices that their forebears had to make. And I just wonder if any of the later generations of actors have said, you know, why did you give that, you know, why?
No, not at all. Because I think if you come from where I come from, that's immediately understood. I've had the occasional complaint, but the then mayor of Puerto Rico, Felicia Rincón, was very unhappy about the way the Puerto Ricans were represented in the movie. She was not a happy camper. And that's the kind of tough thing. Also, the lyrics to America were changed, particularly the verse was really nasty about Puerto Rico in the Broadway production. If you listen to the Broadway version of the verse, where she says, Puerto Rico, my heart's devotion, let it sink back in the ocean. In the original, Puerto Rico, you ugly island, island of tropic diseases. When I got the role, I was so worried and frightened that I would somehow be forced to say those words. And I remember talking to Robert Weiss about it, and he said, oh, don't worry, we're not going to have those lyrics. But it was very scary for a long time while I was still in rehearsals, what we were going to do about those words.
Let's talk about some of your television work. It includes this very intense work on the HBO prison series, Oz, where you play Sister Peterie.
I loved every moment of it. I felt so privileged to be working with these astonishing actors. And I think that the scandal of that series is that no one was ever even nominated for an Emmy, and I know why. I mean, I'm guessing that
why do
I know
you think?
Why. Well, it's because a lot of homosexuality. And, you know, mostly that, I think, and it was an extremely violent show. This was, by the way, before, I guess we kind of opened the door for The Sopranos. I began to get marvelous ideas for my character, so I would submit them to Tom Fontana, who wrote it and produced it. I said to him one day, you know, I've always wondered what the sensual life of a religious person is like, and, you know, what are the yearnings? And his eyebrows shot up to his hairline. He said, what a great idea. Oh, I said to him, it would be wonderful if I could get a crush on one of my patients. You know, so I was thinking someone my age who just began to engage me in conversation and just reeled me in, and he just loved that. This is why I'm an actress and he's a writer, because he put me with the sexual predator of the whole prison, Chris Maloney.
We have a clip of the two of you together. Let's play that.
Hello, Chris.
Hey, you sister.
Can I talk to you?
Sure. What's going on here? You want?
You missed our last two sessions. Why?
Ever since our last time together, when you got me to open up, I've been afraid to come back. Afraid to expose any more of myself to you. I mean, you know, the reality is, sister, I hate myself.
All the more reason why you should have come to me.
You're probably right. Do you know what it's like to want somebody? To long for them. And I'm not talking about sex. I'm just to touch them.
Yeah.
Of course you do. And you're a psychologist or a nun. But you're a woman first. You know about desire.
Everything all right in there, sister?
I'm fine.
Spicy. My goodness.
We had such a great chemistry, Chris and I. It was really, really marvelous. Oh, God, we had such fun. He's a very sexy fellow.
Yeah.
And I and I was the envy of every woman and gay man in America. Just always pleases me is that he was so delighted that we had such a great chemistry together. I mean, it's just so, so deeply unlikely that Christopher Maloney and I would ever get it on.
I don't know about that.
I don't think so, Michelle.
That was legendary performer Rita Moreno speaking with me back in 2007. She's now 82 years old. She's still working after nearly 7 decades in show business. And we want to leave you with just a little more of Rita Moreno's wisdom. Here she is earlier this year accepting a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Screen Actors Guild.
Hopefully it's early in the third act of my life. So let me say this. As I approach the prime of my life, I find I have the time of my life. Learning to enjoy at my leisure all the simple pleasures. And so I happily concede. This is all I ask. This is all I need.
And from one legendary entertainment diva to a diva in training, and why I say that will become clear in a moment. As we mentioned, our last broadcast is scheduled for August 1st, so as we wind down production, we thought it would be nice to hear about the music that members of our staff are listening to as part of our regular series, In Your Ear. And here's a little taste of what's on producer Bridget Armstrong, the diva in training. This is what's on her personal playlist.
Hi, I'm Bridget Armstrong. I'm Tell Me More's self-appointed pop culture expert, and here's what's playing in my ear.
See, every time you come around, you got to bring Jim, James, Paul, and Tyrone.
Tyrone by Erykah Badu. I love, love, love Erykah Badu, and Call Tyrone is actually my go-to karaoke song. I'm not really a great singer, but I have amazing stage presence.
So matter of fact, I think you better call Tyrone. Call and tell him, come on, help you.
In fact, it's the song I sang the night I met my boyfriend. He was the target of all of my, you know, Call Tyrone anger. It was hilarious. People thought that we were some old angry couple. But obviously, he didn't think I was too crazy. He got my phone number, and we're together now. Another song playing in my ear is Click My Finger by Erupt. This is a great dancehall song. It came out when I was in college, so it reminds me of all my college days and clubbing. I just love how the song comes on with like the first.
Click my finger, girl, on the roll with me, yeah. Say them on the stroll with me, girl, from all over the world in the West Indies, yeah. Say them fall in love with me, I'ma click my finger, girl, on the roll with me. Yeah.
To this day, if the song comes on, I can't help but do the whole click date.
West Indies, yeah. Say them fall in love with me. All I fight through them, one be the closest to me. Video light, girl, I take off them clothes, make me see. She know me now, I stand up and pose, make me see.
After the day, we will do something instrumental. After the dance, we are going to have some fun.
Another song is Marvin Gaye's I Wanna Be Where You Are. My father is pretty much an old school music connoisseur, and Marvin Gaye is one of his all-time favorites. He played so much Marvin Gaye growing up, you know, I would get annoyed like, Dad, can we listen to TLC? Can we listen to Brandy? And he's telling me, you know, Marvin Gaye, this is real music. You'll appreciate it one day. And of course, he was right.
We're gonna kiss each other after the dance. And we're gonna hold our father after the dance.
one of the things that Marvin Gaye did was record alternate versions of some of his songs. So this version is the music from I Wanna Be Where You Are, but the lyrics are kind of a remix on After the Dance. And I just love how he put it together. It's such a smooth song. It really does remind me of my childhood and the lectures my father would give to me on real music. After the dance, after the dance, after the
dance, baby, we gon' keep ourselves a That was Tell Me More producer Bridget Armstrong telling us what's playing in her ear. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.